Okay. I want to start again from Pasuk Yutes. Perek Gimel Pasuk Yutes. We ended last week. We led up to the grand assassination. I want to move back a couple of psukim. We moved through it quickly, and I want to just go through the actual assassination again, because there are a number of points that really need to be highlighted. So in Perek Gimel Pasuk Yutes, we saw that, yes, Ehud had come with an entourage bearing a gift for Eglon, the king of Moab. Ehud, for the different strategic reasons we discussed last week, left, went back with his entourage, and then all of a sudden, when they were already back in Eretz Yisrael, basically, he, so to speak, remembered something he had forgot to tell Eglon. So we'll begin from Pasuk Yutes. Those shav min ha-psilim asher etz ha-Gilgal. He came back from Psilim, which was near Gilgal, meaning they had already reached basically back into Eretz Yisrael, and he turned around and came back. Came back to the king by himself. The rest of the company was gone. Vayomer, and he said, Devar seser li elecha ha-melech. I have something concealed for you, O king. Vayomer has. So he said, quiet. And he quiet, don't say anything yet until everybody is out of here. Vayitzu me'alov kol ha'oimdim alov. And everybody left. So again, why he wasn't suspicious, etc., we discussed last week. But lemaisa, now we have Ehud alone with the king.
What's the Selim mean?
It's a place. The name of a place.
Does it mean quarries or something?
What's that? Yes, you're referring to Chazal that say it actually means places where they dug up quarries, where they dug rock. Yeah. Now,
had they not left all alone?
What's that?
What would you have done had there been guards?
Don't know. When you plan an assassination, you're always taking ifs and unclarities into account.
Was he doing a suicide mission here?
So we said last week that Lamaisa Apiderech HaTeva, he should not have been able to get away with this. Chazal at great length described the miracles that he needed to get away, even though he himself did the Hishtadlis.
But did he expect
but
to
the
get
miracles
away?
So it's quite likely that he did not. Meaning apparently if a person is going and knowing that Apiderech HaTeva, he needs Nisim, we know that you're not supposed to rely on Nisim. Apparently he was ready to give up his life, which is also what we explained earlier. He didn't want to endanger anybody else, that's why he waited until everybody was gone. Apparently in his mind he was ready to give up his life. He was going to try to get out, but as far as he was concerned, he was ready to give up his life. Now, what's that? We'll see. Yeah, that's what we saw last week. Yeah. Now, what difference does it make? What's that? Oh, meaning, I thought you were asking.
It's so bad that it required that kind of a...
The very fact that the Jews were being oppressed warranted it.
Yes.
And they were being oppressed. Exactly to what extent, we don't know. We do know that they captured a city of the Jews that we saw last week.
The city?
The city of Iratmar in the city of Dates, that suburb of Yericho. Yeah. But in those times, any form of oppression was considered. Okay. So now, the Eud Ba'ilav. Now, Eud approached him. And he was sitting out in his airy patio that he had by himself. And Ehud said, Dvar Elohim li Elecha. I bring to you the word of Hashem. So here Chazal infer that actually, yes. What word of Hashem was he bringing? What he was about to do. That Hashem had instructed him to do this. And that was also meant when he said earlier, I have something concealed for you. He meant, I'm going to conceal a knife in your fat.
What does that mean, Eliyahu?
Aliyah is like an attic or a patio. It's not an attic, it's an open attic, a patio. Vayomer Ehud dvar Elokim li'elecha. And Ehud told him, I bring to you the word of Hashem. Vayokom al hakisei. Ooh, Eglon. This was a certain pinnacle, is that how you say it? That he had reached. Hashem is finally recognizing Eglon's worthiness and is sending him a... This was, for Eglon, this was a landmark. Hashem is recognizing him. And he's sending him a message.
You know, the considered Nevi'im coming out with it. You still see Jewish leaders as Nevi'im?
Very much so. We already saw last week that yes, he knew the Jewish Hashem and he respected the Jewish Hashem and believed in it. Somehow, there's a will, there's a way. Somehow that did not conflict with oppressing the Jewish people, as has been the case with many people in the past, and Bilam and others believed in Hashem. Somehow that didn't conflict, and apparently he's considered himself an important person and was flattered by the fact that Hashem wanted to ask him for something, or whatever it is he thought. Whatever it is, he held this in reverence and he stood up. And as we discussed last week, for him to stand up was not a simple thing. It was a big act of dedication. He had to heave all of himself out of the chair. So now, you just want to note something here, the Mepharshim note. Ehud told him, beforehand he told him, I have something secret to tell you, O King. That's how you talk to a king. O King. I think it's an Irish name. O'Malley. So, O King. Here he doesn't say that. I bring to you the word of Hashem. There's no more king here. What happened? So, the Mepharshim say that no, when he was actually coming and delivering the word of Hashem, even Eglon was able to appreciate that a person who's actually talking on behalf of Hashem does not have to say, O King. Rabbi Leib Chassman said, the mashal for this is when the French consul is at a state dinner in the English palace, talks to the king with all due reverence. Or when the French consul is actually delivering a personal message from the King of France to the King of England, he speaks as an equal. Now I come representing the King of France, he speaks as an equal. And therefore, once he's actually getting ready to deliver the word of Hashem, this is something even Eglon can appreciate and respect. There's no more O King now. Beforehand, when he came to say, I have a message for you. Well, once he's actually standing here and telling him, I'm bringing you the word of Hashem, once he's telling him that he's bringing the word of Hashem, there's no more O King. But the Moshe David Vali, this is one of the big Mekubalim. He was a Talmud of the Ramchal. One of the big Mekubalim, he has very voluminous Sfarim. But he says something very profound there. He says there's a deeper reason why he didn't say O King here. He says because at this minute, Ehud's reign ended in Shamayim. Every person has their period of reign in Shamayim. In Shamayim, Ehud sensed this. Eglon. Ehud sensed that in Shamayim, Eglon's reign had ended this moment, which was also manifested in the fact that he got off his throne. You hear that? In Shamayim, he wasn't the king anymore. And therefore, he was no king to address. He just said, I bring to you the word of Hashem. And
who's Eglon? What?
Yeah. That's right. I don't know how to cheshbon the seconds. I don't know. Okay. What? Rav Moshe David Vali. It's a Talmud of the Ramchal. Bayokom Alakis. Okay. So he stood up, and this we sing this again. This is a noteworthy sign of respect that this fat guy who was oppressing the Jewish people was ready to show Hashem, and Chazal make a big deal about this. Meaning, Chazal making a big deal about it. Chazal notes that Hashem made a big deal about it. Chazal say, first of all, yes, because of this sign of respect, this was a big thing. For a non-Jewish king to get up for the word of Hashem was a big thing. Wasn't enough to commute his sentence, but it was a big thing. And therefore they said that he had the schus for this reason, that Rus came from him. He ended up becoming the great-grandfather, or whatever, more than that, of David HaMelech.
How's that considered a reward, though, if he's in Gehenna and he can't enjoy it?
What's that? He does enjoy it. How that works exactly, I can't tell you, but the fact that he knows for all of eternity that he had a contributing hand in David HaMelech because of his merit adds something to him, somehow or the other. How that works, I don't know. Now, what's that? The question is from whom? The fact that he had the schus of fathering him, or of great-great-great-grandfathering him, was considered a big schus. Now Chazal take this a step further, and they say that Hashem actually leveled this as a taina at the Jewish people. He said, what's that?
Didn't Haman have the CD that was teaching Torah in Israel?
The question is, what is it, in his schus or not? I don't know how much we accredit Lavan with this chusum. We all come from Lavan, we come from Grandpa Terach. But the question is, was it his chus? So now Chazal take this further, and Chazal say that Hashem actually levels this as a taina to Jewish people. Hashem says, look how Goyim honor me. Why don't you honor me? Why don't we feel the reverence that Eglon felt whenever we are encountering the word of Hashem that's directed towards us? Hashem holds this is a taina to Jewish people. Now the truth is, it's justifiable, to an extent, it's justifiable. There was once a big dinner, some sort of big dinner in the States, on behalf of the State of Israel, one of these things, and they had one of the big leaders of the State of Israel. I don't know who it was, and he was the guest of honor there. And one of the people got up and asked him an embarrassing question. He said, why is it that the US dollar says in God we trust and the Israeli shekel doesn't?
It's a good question, isn't it?
That's a good question. That's right. And to him it was an embarrassing question. But, and here I'll say that at the end of the day we see that there's a difference between the old timers and the new timers. Off the cuff he responded as follows.
I'm an old timer?
This is an old timer. Old timers showing are still of a different quality. Off the cuff, he said as follows. He said, you know what the difference is? They can say it and go on with their life as usual. Once we say it, we have to change everything around. And therefore we can't say it. Okay? So, there's a lot to that. Yes, Goyim can respect, they can show reverence and this. And he can keep on oppressing the Jewish people. That's what everyone had in mind. Awful lot of respect for Hashem, but business is business. Right? So, that's number one. Number two, familiarity. We're zeichet to be so close to Hashem all the time, it's hard to retain that reverence. Yet at the same time, Chazal are gleaning a certain admonition at the Jewish people, because at the end of the day, it's true. When Eglon was not a better guy than we are Jews. No. But, the ma'aseh, we do see from them objective displays of appropriate behavior towards Hashem. And these are things that, even though it's harder for us, even though it's more of a challenge, we should note these things and aim to implement them. In fact, Darkei Moshe, the Ramah, cites those who derive from here. We know there's a machlekes between the Ashkenazim and the Sfaradim, where they have to stand for Adova Shebikdusha. You have to stand for Kaddish, Kedusha. Well, Kedusha is the story of Kaddish. Adova Shebikdusha. You have to stand. Right? And Darkei Moshe says that some derive it from here. Eglon stood up when the word of Hashem was being brought. And from here we derive that for a Adova Shebikdusha you stand. Not a simple thing.
Just for Yesh Min Rabba or for the whole
thing? The meaning of the Ashkenazim is to stand for all of Kaddish. The meaning of the Sfaradim is not.
So technically people are sitting down and then, you know, they get up for Yesh Min Rabba and they stay up. Is that just incorrect, or is that...
But one should stand from the beginning of Kaddish. Yeah.
Why does Sfaradim
not stand? Well, the Arizal said that the source that derives it from here is a mistake. Okay? So we have two big people on either side. But the Sfaradim will generally follow the Arizal. But there's more to it. It's Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Whatever it is, yes, the fact that he stood up is something that's not meant to be missed. Something that's meant to be noticed and learned from. Okay, we move on. Now, Vayishlach Ehud says, basically we're up to last week. Vayishlach Ehud et yad smoyloi, Vayikach es acherev me'al yerech yeminoi. Ehud took his left hand and pulled out the sword that was on his right thigh, Vayiska Ehobevitnoi, and he stuck it into his belly. Vayavoy gam hanitzav achar alav. Now, as we said, first of all, as we saw, he had sharpened both sides. This went all the way in. Plus, the guy was very fat. So, it would basically, I don't know if he was up to his elbow in fat, but it says that, yes, the handle followed the blade in. Vayisgah acherev bad alav. And then the fat closed over it. Ki vayishalap acherev mibitnoi. Because he did not pull the dagger out. He didn't have extra time on his hands right now. The handle. And the feces, he had pierced his intestines, and some of the feces started coming out. Now this is the reason this is significant, is because this is going to help in his escape, as we'll see. What's that? Oh, so the truth is that Chazal note this and other things as nisim. As nisim to aid Ehud's escape. Now, Vayetze Ehud amizderoino. So now Ehud went out to the wall. And as we discussed before, the truth is that his chances of escape were nil. And he wasn't going here, presumably, relying on a nace. But yet, he is... remains cool-headed, and he's not, you know, I did what I did and now I'm dead. Didn't turn the gun on himself and shoot. No. Now he's remaining level-headed. Now his ishtablus is to get himself out alive. But briefly, I want to
mention moving.
I said, it's going to be significant soon to his escape. Let's see. So now, he remains level-headed. He steps out into the hall. He decided he's going to utilize the stuff that came out to his advantage. How? He stepped out. He closed the doors to this patio, right? This was an open patio. Closed the doors. And he locked it. Meaning, these were primitive locks. It wasn't like, you know, he locked it and that was that. But it could be locked on either side. He locked and he left the key there. But the point is, the door was closed and locked. The guards come back, they find the door closed and locked. It means that the king is busy. And now they had another indication that the king was busy. They smelled it. He was going to the bathroom. So all this, what's that?
Was that in the bathroom?
Wasn't there, but apparently. Or apparently he had one off it. Or did what he needed to do. You gotta go. So now, in any case, whatever it is, they came, doors locked, they smelled it. There's not much speculation to do. So, the Hu Yatsa, now he left nonchalantly. Vavadav Bo. Oh, so the servants understood, now they can come back in, the guards. Vine Dalsi Saliya Nu'ulais. By the time they got there, they found that the doors to the patio were locked. And they also, the Mepharshim stressed that they sniffed what was going on. Apparently he's covering his legs. That's an expression for going to the bathroom on the patio. So they waited. And they waited. They continued to wait. Person has a stomach disorder, but after an hour, they started feeling uneasy. And he still wasn't opening. So now they already started getting uneasy. They started suspecting that something is wrong. So they took the key and they opened it up. And their master was collapsed on the floor, dead. Now all this gave Ehud time to get away. Ehud nimlat ad yismamom. Ehud fled while they tarried. V'ho'avaris ha'psilim. He ran past that psilim area. V'imaleit ha'sirosa. And he escaped into the forest. I don't know. V'yehi b'voyoy. And then as he arrived back into Eretz Yisrael territory, v'yiska ba'sheifor b'har Ephraim. And he sounded the shofar on Har Ephraim. This was a general alarm. They heard him blowing the shofar. They came running. And he led the pack. Vayomer aleihem, and he yelled to them, "Ridfu acharei, come, chase behind me." Ki nosan Hashem es oyveichem es moyav biyedchem. Because now Hashem has delivered your enemies moyav into your hands. Apparently, lemaisa they did depend on Eglon to coordinate things. I don't know exactly what the technicalities were. Whatever it is, this was their chance. Vayodua acharav, or just pandemonium broke loose. It was a general confusion, and these Jews ran after him. Now, what they did now was, he immediately, the first place he went to was a bridge. There was a bridge connecting Moyav to Eretz Yisrael. He closed off the bridge. That was the first thing. Why? Because, what's that? They captured the bridge leading from the Yarden to Moyav. And they didn't let anybody pass. Meaning what happened was like this. They wanted to cut off the Moyav headquarters in Eretz Yisrael from Moyav. So therefore, as we saw, Moyav headquarters was right outside Yericho, which is basically right on the other side of the Yarden. The Yericho was on the eastern side of the Yarden, Moyav was on the western side of the Yarden, and it was this bridge. So the first thing he did was, he severed the connection, captured the bridge, cut off the bridge. Now, in Moyav, everything. What's that? I don't know. I guess. Oh, here you have it on authority. So, what's that? I don't know if it was a bridge or if it was just passageways. Whatever it is, he blocked the passageways.
That's where you cross. That's a very easy cross.
Not a very big deal. Okay.
It used to be much bigger.
What's that?
They diverted a lot of the water. That's why today.
Say it's smaller.
It's
not okay.
Used to be much smaller.
Right. So he cut that off. Now there's this Moyav headquarters inside Eretz Yisrael territory, but they're cut off. Back in Moyav, pandemonium reigns. Right. Everybody's panicking. There's turmoil. They don't know what to do. Now they've cut off the connection. And next thing is, by Yakuetz Moyav Beisai Kaseres Alofim Ish. Then they moved back into Eretz Yisrael and smote all of the Moyavim in Eretz Yisrael. Kol Shamein, all of the nobles. This either means nobles, according to the Radak, or it means all of the fearsome fighters. The Kol Ishchayil, all of the mighty warriors. Beloy Nimlat Ish, nobody got away. They completely wiped out the Moyav headquarters. And Moyav was subdued on that day, Tachas Yad Yisrael, under the hands of Yisrael. And then things were quiet for 80 years.
They didn't go to war. They just wiped out.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's all's well that ends well. We'll just note again that we have to always take note of these passing little statements at the end. And the land was quiet for 80 years. Once again, that's pretty significant. Things were quiet for 80 years, which means that there were no troubles because the Jewish people were deemed to be on the right level. As we keep seeing, they sinned, so this began. There were tzaddis for 18 years, quiet for 80. Okay. The Acharav Hayosham Gar Ben Anos. After Ehud was Shamgar ben Anos. He gets very little mention. The next Shefet. What's his big achievement? Vayaches plishtim sheishmeris ish b'malmad ha'boka. He personally smote 600 plishtim with a goad, with a cattle goad. Killed 600 men.
A goad?
It's like a spur, the thing that you drive the cattle with. And he too affected salvation for the Jewish people. That's it. That's the whole story of Shamgar ben Anos. Very short shrift. Chazal tells us that the truth is that, again, you know, killing 600 people is not like, you know, one of these spectacular battles. Spectacular that one man did it with the cattle goad. But we're not talking about something of a major scale here. His effect wasn't that great. His influence wasn't all that great. Shamgar ben Anos was from Shevet Shimon, which once again we've already seen in the past that Shevet Shimon ended up the most pathetic Shevet among Klal Yisrael, which is manifested in the fact also that all the Shvatim had a Shevet, Shimon barely had a Shevet. They had Shamgar ben Anas, his entire period of Shevethood, we'll call it that, was a year. And even that year was overlapping with Ehud's last year. Ehud was already old. Shamgar basically was the last year of Ehud's reign. He achieved this small victory, scared, warded the Plishtim off.
So
but nothing
years,
so major.
There's 80 years and he was there for 1 year. What about, why hasn't anyone else met in 79 years?
No, this was apparently during Ehud's lifetime. Ah, coming up, yeah. That's what we're going to see now. He didn't lead the Jews really by himself. Meaning Ehud, maybe was already older than, he led a little bit. Like, they make a point, the Mefarshim make a point of stressing this, that Shamgar ben Anas' whole period of being a Shevet was kind of minimal, and his leadership was limited, and his influence and effect was limited. It also didn't last, right, as we're going to see now. It wasn't very long-lasting, it wasn't all that significant. Now, yep, as you just pointed out, and the Jewish people then went ahead and did more bad in the eyes of Hashem, and Ehud had died. Meaning, really, Ehud was the one holding the fort. Once he died, things started slipping. Yeah, there was kind of Shamgar, it was a little bit at the transitional point, right before Ehud's death, but really, Ehud had been holding the fort. Ehud died, things started slipping. Shamgar had not really affected a full change. Yeah, that's the point. He was the spiritual leader of the Jewish people. Yeah. And now what happens? And here, we move on to what's going to be the preface of one of the most spectacular parashiyos in Shoftim that we'll really be seeing next week. Here we're leading up to the story of Devorah. But before the story of Devorah, there's its little preface. Vayimkerem Hashem b'yad Yavin melech Kena'an asher molach b'chotzar. Hashem sold them into the hands of Yavin, the king of Kena'an, who had reigned in Chotzar.
Isn't Chotzar already destroyed already?
Oh, good question. Chotzar was destroyed, the kings of Kena'an were destroyed. Chotzar had been destroyed by Yeshua. This Yavin, king of Kena'an, had apparently gotten a reign, gotten away, and therefore Asher Malach b'Chotzar, it's in the past tense, he had been the king in Chotzar before Yeshua destroyed it.
The last king.
Yeah, and he was driven away. Apparently, he made it away with his life, but he was never killed, and he started setting up shop again. He's coming back to haunt the Jewish people. Now, as we've already seen, we pointed this out the other week, the first two periods of oppression were by outsiders, right? It was Kushan Rishosayim of Aram, and then Eglon of Moab. These are both outsiders, you can even call them cousins, okay? But, as we said, it was Hashem not pouring salt on the wounds. But now already, it's a next step in the deterioration. Hashem is already throwing the seven nations back in their face. Now we have a Kenani king coming and gaining control over them. The Sar Tzva'oi, and his general was Sisra, and he's really the star of the show here. Yavin wasn't who knows what, but with a Sisra, anybody is big.
Anybody is
big. You got a general like Sisra on your side. Chazal say amazing things about this Sisra. He was a prodigy in the world of fighting. Basically, Chazal say that Sisra, leading Yavin's forces, Sisra basically conquered the civilized world, meaning he basically conquered all of civilization at that time. I don't know if this, to what extent this means. It could be that he made them into vassals, etc. But Lamaisa Sisra was this was all accomplished by the age of 30. By the age of 30, he had basically conquered all of civilization, and he was known as a fearsome, awesome person who can paralyze with his voice. That he was able to paralyze animals. That's how he hunted. He roared, and the animals froze. a fearsome person. V'hu yoshev b'charoshes ha'goyim. And he settled in a place called Charoshes ha'goyim. Charoshes ha'goyim is either just the name of the place, or it actually denotes in a metropolis of goyim, meaning they set up a major headquarters. Again, we saw that this Yavin, well, he was more like the little guy, but Sisera really is the main star of the show here, had set up a very good thing. They basically were now controlling many nations. He set up a major headquarters in Eretz Yisrael in a place called Charoshes ha'goyim. They made a big metropolis there. And from there, that was their headquarters. That was where they reigned from. And there was this, the Mefarshim say, it's called Charoshes ha'goyim, the stronghold of goyim. It wasn't called the stronghold of Canaan. It was called the stronghold of goyim. Why? The Targum Yonasan, Rashi, the Rabbah, they all say that actually what was going on here was they had representatives from all around the world. And they were all here working together to keep the Jews at bay. Not just to keep the Jews at bay, but actually to ultimately subdue them, subjugate them. They were all excited about the fact that now they have this headquarters in Canaan. Finally, they have a big shot who really managed to get the situation under control.
They wanted to annihilate.
It's quite likely that that was the ultimate objective. Or at least to conquer.
By that point, he conquered the whole world.
What's that? Chazal tell us that, yeah, he had basically conquered all of civilization. I don't know how far out that was. What's that?
And Eretz Yisrael was the last holdout?
No. They ruled there too. They ruled. And his headquarters was this Charoshes ha'goyim, this area that we're calling Stronghold of Goyim. Now, during this period, again, they did not drive the Jews out. Maybe that was going to be the objective, but the Jews were subject to them, and they gave them a very hard time. The Jewish people cried out to Hashem. He had a very mighty army. He had 900 iron chariots. Now, 900 chariots is not who knows what, but these iron chariots were of a special quality. And the point is that that's an indication of how large his army was. If you want to know what sort of indication it is, Paroi was the strongest army in the world at that time. How many chariots did he have? 600. Sisera had 900. Yeah, we're talking about just based on this cheshbon, it's 1.5 times what Paroi's army was. We're talking about a very, very formidable army. Yeah, sure. And he oppressed the Jewish people exceedingly for 20 years. So here also, we're noting, with each new oppression, it's getting longer and longer. The first one was 8 years, now it's 18 years, now it's 20 years. So, the matzav was terrible. All it says here the Navi is very cryptic. The Navi says, he oppressed them exceedingly. But later in Shiraz Dvara we see her describing a little bit more in detail what life was like in Eretz Yisrael at that time. First of all, it wasn't safe to live in the open. Everybody lived in walled cities. It was no longer safe to live in the open. Meaning apparently,
anarchy?
What's that?
Anarchy?
To an extent, yeah. Meaning he didn't actually set up government in all the cities, but his people marauded and plundered, etc. And it was very scary to be outside. They lived in pockets, walled cities. It was scary to step outside. Sometimes they had to. She describes the terror of when people went to draw water. She says later. She said when they would sneak out to draw water, it was a whole.
What are we talking about?
The Jewish people, when they had to get out of those walled cities to go draw water. Okay, this might have been walls in the wells in the city, but if they had to go, let's say, to a river or something to get water, it was a whole secret operation, which was done in terror. They snuck out, hoping that they wouldn't be seen, to the extent that she describes how when they crunched over the gravel, they jumped. And they were working so hard not to make a sound. The enemy was all over the place, and it was scary. So she describes the fear that they had when they crunched gravel right near the water. Later, it's Devira, we'll see. We're leading up to her. But this is part of the oppression that we're describing here. Now, it's not just this. Chazal say that there was another element of the persecution here. Just one more point from Shira Zvera also. Again, it's hard to paint a picture of exactly what the reality was. But also, the situation was such that people were scared to take public positions. Apparently, there was a fear of attracting attention to yourself. It says teachers basically were scared to teach, judges were scared to judge. It was basically a reign of terror throughout that period. But there was more to it, Chazal said. Kushan Rishosayim and Eglon, we just saw about Eglon. These are people who acknowledged Hashem's supremacy. Right? They were just trying to get the Jews out of the way and make the world a better place. But this was already a different story. Sisra, a big part of his campaign was Chirufim v'Gidufim, Chazal said. He was out there to spite Hashem. He was out there against everything the Jews stood for. And he regularly, loudly, was busy cursing Hashem. Apparently this doesn't mean that he sat around this table cursing, but he broadcasted his attitudes in a very big way somehow. I don't know how it worked in those days. But this was all about mudslinging against Hashem in a direct way. And this was also torture for the Jewish people. Meaning, yes, you see the Jewish people sin, this, that. But this was something that drove them to terrible despair. To hear their Hashem being spoken about this way, and it's going on and on for 20 years, was something that was driving them to depths of despair. And therefore the Malbim says, up till now it said, Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem. Here it says, Vayitzaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem. Both are translated as, they cried out to Hashem. But the Malbim, master of Lashon, says, Vayitzaku is a much stronger expression. Se'oka is a much stronger expression than Za'oka. I can't explain why, but if it comes from the Malbim, he is the authority on Lashon. So he says they cried out more desperately than they had ever cried out before. Now, it was more than, so as we're seeing, first of all, there was the reign of terror. Second of all, there was the spiritual torture. But it was also more than that. They had never faced such a formidable army. Right, there had never been such a situation. The Jews, this was a precedent. Each situation had been a precedent. We showed already. Kushan was the first time that somebody was able to make tzaras. Eglon was the first time the city was actually captured. But this was the first time they actually had a mighty army occupying Eretz Yisrael, making it basically hopeless for the situation to be reversed. That's it. The Jews' period of glory had passed. Somebody came in with a superpower army, and that was it. There was no hope of changing things. This also made them desperate, which actually was a bracha. Right? As we say, as long as you can still count on politics and military maneuvers, etc., here already with his 900 chariots, and also, as we see, we saw alluded to here, and we'll see it all also later, it wasn't just his army. As we said, he was busy with the whole world, and he had military representatives of all the different armies of the world who were all partners to his agenda of getting the Jews. So the Jews cried out in a level of despair like they had never cried out before. Probably also very scared. This is going on for so long and his army is building and building. Maybe he's just going to come and wipe out Eretz Yisrael. So the Jews reached the desired level of crying out to Hashem, and therefore Hashem is ready to start setting up the Yeshua. Where does the Yeshua come? So this starts being described in the next pasuk. Udvayra Isha Nevia Eishes Lapidus. Right? This is, we're not just introducing a character here. The Malbim stresses this is directly following. They cried out to Hashem. So enter the Vayra. It's to be taken as a response, right? So they're crying out to Hashem. They cry out to Hashem. What did Hashem do? Udvayra Isha Nevia Eishes Lapidus. So the Malbim says, this pasuk is describing to us all the different things that are going to go on now as in the form of salvation. Udvayra Isha Nevia Eishes Lapidus. He Sheftas Israel Ba'esahi. Oh, okay, so let's see. We have to analyze this pasuk word by word. Dvaira Isha Nevia. First of all, we have Dvaira. She's a prophetess. We already have a source of schus. But, as we've been seeing, the question is, with all the Shoftim, how influential will they be? Right? We saw that there's a set pattern, there's bureaucracy that the salvation has to follow. Hashem provides. They reach the realization, right? Set pattern. They reach the realization. Hashem provides a Shoftim. That's an opportunity for them to be influenced. If they are, then the Shoftim can go out and earn salvation. So, the variation of Yah. First of all, yes, Hashem has the prophetess in place. Variation of Yah. Eshes Lapidos. She was a lady of Lapidos. So here there are three pshatim, which are really all interconnected. Eshes Lapidos, the Mepharshim say, the simple understanding is, she was a fiery woman. Eshes Lapidos, a woman, a flamey woman. Lapidos means flames. Right? She was a fiery woman, meaning she was a passionate woman, she was an energetic woman, and she was, that's why she was a great personality. Some people are fiery, they just have bad tempers, but this was a woman who put all her passion into her service of Hashem. Now, how did that manifest? So she was Eshes Lapidos, she was the wife of Lapidos. It was also her husband's name, a way of referring to her husband. Possibly Barak. Not 100% clear? We'll see later, she's going to team up with a man named Barak, who is possibly identified as her husband, which works well. Right. Mepharshim say, Chazal say that, but some Mepharshim still say that that's not the Pashut Pshat. We'll see. We will discuss that, but we'll get there. Whatever it is, that would work well, because Barak means like a flash, Lapidos means flame, so the name can be well interchangeable. So she was the wife of Lapidos. Now Chazal say, Lapidos has yet a third connotation. And all these really go together. Lapidos means flames. She was a woman of flames, quite literally. What does that mean? What did she do? She used to form wicks for the Beis HaMikdash. That was her thing. She used to make wicks, not for the Beis HaMikdash, I'm sorry, there was no Beis HaMikdash then, for the Mishkan. She made wicks for the Beis HaMikdash, for the Mishkan, to use for the Menorah. Now, was it just that? That one time she heard an inspiring shmooze about providing light for the Mishkan? No. She had a deeper motive here. She was married to Lapidos. She was a very, very great, deep, intellectual woman. A prophetess. She was a Nevi'ah. Her husband was a simpleton. An Am Ha'aretz. In terms of those days, I don't know exactly what that means. But he was a simpleton.
Wouldn't Lapidos kind of connotate like someone who's more than that, someone who's great?
What's that?
I mean, the name Barak or Lapidos, someone who's strong, someone who's fiery.
Yes, it does. But again, as we're saying, Lapidos is mainly a description of her. It also happens to be his name. But
she married below her level.
What's that?
She married below her stature.
Oh, so what we're going to see now is that in the eyes of the true Jewish wife, there's no such thing. This is what's coming up now. And this is really where her greatness came. She was not a woman who was out there influencing the crowds. What was her agenda? Her husband was a simple guy. She wanted to bring out his potential, which she believed was there. And therefore, her trick was, she started making wicks for the Beis HaMikdash, for the Mishkan, sorry. From now on, the Beis HaMikdash means the Mishkan, okay? I'm going to say it a few more times. She made wicks for the Mishkan, and she sent them with him. For what purpose? Being around the Mishkan was very inspiring, especially in those days. And therefore, she knew he'd be around there, he'd be influenced, he'd be inspired, and he'd become a greater person. I don't know exactly to what extent, but he'd become a greater person. This was her agenda in life. To the extent that she's described by that, right? We tag her as the woman who made wicks. Now, we get back to the fact that she was a fiery, passionate woman who was also very deep and intellectual. She was a prophetess. Right? She could have been out there running all the seminaries in Israel. But what was she busy doing? All of her koiches were invested into what? Those means of bringing out more greatness out of her husband. This turned her into a leader in Klal Yisrael. We'll see soon. It's a very interesting phenomenon. A female leader of Klal Yisrael. We'll see. But where did it come from? Where did it come from? We're saying how all these three are really just one point. All that fire, all that passion, all that devotion on a practical level. So what was she busy doing? A wife's job is to invest in her husband. Wife's job is not to be raising Klal Yisrael, not to be inspiring Klal Yisrael, etc., etc. As we'll see soon, those who wanted came to her. She wasn't out there teaching. We'll see soon. She was praised for what other sheikhs did, for what other leaders were blamed for. Right? She stayed home. So, like you said, it would seem like overkill. Such a woman wasted on a guy like that. No, what was her approach? Her approach was all those kaychas, the kaychas that brought her to the level of nevuah, going to what? She didn't come to the local rav and say, "The guy's just not on my level. You know, I just this is not what I heard about him." This was her whole focus in life, putting all of those unbelievable kaychas into this man. That was the vibe. This is what made her into the woman that she was.
Was it so simple just to send him to Shiloh during the day? The way we described it here, it was a very dangerous time just to take wicks to go to Shiloh.
I don't know how they managed it. Well, we'll see soon that she ended up clearing out the way completely. But that we'll see already next week. Okay. Come to you.